Thank you to Wildcare and Wildlife Acoustics for sponsoring the Bat Chat podcast.
Can you hear that? We can. Wildlife Acoustics creates the world's leading bat acoustic monitoring tools, designed to help scientists make impactful discoveries for our biologically diverse planet, turning this into this. Visit wildlifeacoustics.com to learn more.
Wildcare are committed to supporting the ecology industry and are specialists in supplying a large range of monitoring, conservation and habitat management products, as well as equipment hire and service and repair. With a large range of products coupled with friendly and expert help and advice, Wildcare is a favourite supplier for ecologists nationwide. Go to wildcare.co.uk to see the full range and quote BatChat at the checkout for 10% off all bat detectors and bat boxes. Welcome back to Bat Chat from the Bat Conservation Trust, the podcast for anyone who loves bats. As you know by now, we're bringing you stories from the world of bats, and we have a great story for you today. I'm Steve Rowe, I'm an ecologist, as well as a trustee of the Bat Conservation Trust. You can join the conversation online using the hashtag BatChat. This week we have a really special guest. In 2014, the BBC's Natural World series brought us a documentary of one man's mission to save Mexico's bats, as well as its most famous export, tequila. In this interview, recorded at the National Bat Conference back in September, I started by asking Rodrigo Medellin if he was looking forward to opening the UK's National Bat Conference the following day as the keynote speaker.
Well, of course, it's an incredible honour and a pleasure for me to come and give the keynote to the National Bat Conference of the United Kingdom. It's an incredible pleasure and an honour. But it's also true that it's been long coming. We started planning this in 2019 was when they invited me. And then 2020, we all know what happened. And then 2021 came around and nothing happened. I gave actually a Zoom talk for your online National Bat Conference in 2020. And it's not fun. I'm sorry. It's not fun. It's nothing like being with real people.
Yeah.
So this is it. This is finally the time that I can meet you all, be with you, talk bats into the wee hours of the night and so on.
So I know everyone's very excited because you are the Batman of Mexico, which came about through a documentary that was aired in 2014. That documentary that was narrated by David Attenborough, how long in the making was that program?
Oh, well, I don't know how long is your podcast, but let me tell you how it came to be. I won the Whitley Gold Award, which is a big recognition for conservation, biodiversity conservation, in 2012. And for that, David Attenborough prepares a very brief 3-minute long video on the winner. And just hearing David Attenborough say my name, Rodrigo, my God, my heart was jumping out of my chest. So then I came to accept the award, and I told Edward Whitley, I said, do you think he will come? And he said, well, I don't know. I always invite him. He sometimes comes. He sometimes doesn't come. All right. So here I am in the pre-ceremony reception talking to lady, I forget her name. And then out of the corner of my eye, I see David Attenborough walking in and I turn into the most pathetic Justin Bieber fan. And I fall silent and I go, he's there. Okay. So then, we go into the ceremony and beginning of the ceremony, I have Edward Whitley, Princess Anne and David in the first row. And my knees starts, of course, trembling. So then after, I had incredible opportunity of meeting David. And we sat together one-on-one for about an hour and a half or 2 hours or something. And that was the most golden time of my life, even if my wife is listening to this. Then after that hour and a half, he said, well, I don't have any more power in BBC.
Sure.
But whatever little power I have, I'm going to invest in us doing a documentary with you. What? All right. So next evening, then a crew of the BBC shows up and they connect me and they say, okay, we're going to do the documentary. So we're going to be in touch and we're going to plan it and so on. So from beginning to end, it's April 2012 to the final wrap-up happened in July of 2013.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the actual filming occurred over 4 months. Mm-hmm. And we went all the way through from extreme southern Mexico to extreme northern Mexico, filming all kinds of things, from carnivorous bats to vampire bats to lesser long-nosed bats. So then after that, they went into post-production. And then they flew me over again for the taping of David narrating the thing.
Okay.
And of course, that was another incredibly wonderful, amazing experience. And since then, we have a real correspondence between David and I.
Great.
He doesn't do email or WhatsApp or anything. He does letters across the Atlantic with a seal, with a stamp. And I do too. So I have like my letters exchanged with him, which is amazing.
Well, when you next write to him, get him on this podcast. That'd be amazing. So, I mean, one of those species that was featured on that film was the lesser long-nosed bats. And I guess that was a heavily featured species because that's one of the ones that migrates through the west coast of Mexico. That migratory route, you've discovered that yourself from 20 years worth of work. How did you go about finding where the bats were migrating? How much work went into that and how did you do it?
Well, it's been a very long time. We started working with the lesser long-nosed bats in the 80s. 1983 and 84, we did all of the surveys and we found out that the species was endangered. So we listed the species as endangered in the United States in 1988 and as threatened in Mexico in 1994. And then we started the recovery plan, identifying. We knew from old that they were migratory, but we didn't really know, you know, how far, from where, through where, why, when, and so on. So little by little, we've been putting the pieces together to understand what drives the migration. And it turns out that one of the big lessons that we learned, it's that these bats, not all of them migrate. Mm. The males do not migrate. And from the females, only half of them migrate. And the other half stays in central and southern Mexico, and they give birth in the winter, whereas the migratory group gives birth in the summer in the Sonoran Desert. So all of these little things started coming into place. At the same time, we listed the 13 largest colonies in Mexico, and we started monitoring, documenting their population levels, yeah, up and down and up and down with, you know, infrared video and so on. And of course, a lot of environmental education, a lot. And then starting to protect each cave one by one. Within 10 years, we've seen that all of the 13 populations had stabilized or continued to grow. And we started finding new colonies, which was completely unexpected for me. I mean, in fact, one of the new colonies, this is a cave that I've known since I was a teenager. I started going to that cave when I was 14 or 15, and it's never had lesser long-nosed bats. So then we are in the midst of filming the Batman, and two hurricanes move the bats around, so we lose them. We don't know where they are. And one of my students who's working on vampire bats in eastern Mexico, in this same cave, she calls me and she says, Dr. Medina, I hear that you're trying to find where the lesser long-nosed bats are. Well, let me tell you that they're here. I said, no. You don't do this to me. You have no idea. there's no lesser longnose bats there. So go back and hit the books and learn about the species that you're working on, because there's no lesser longnose bat in that cave. And she goes, but Dr. Medellin, they're here and in big numbers. They're here. I said, no, it's been 30 years that I've been visiting that cave and they're not there. She said, but they're here. Okay, I said, okay, they're there. Okay, they're there. Then don't go back into the cave. And I'm going to move my two crews of students from different places in Mexico and the BBC. And we're going to converge in that cave in 2 days. I'll see you there in 2 days. Don't go in. All right. So we go there and I go there by myself and I find thousands and thousands of lesser longnose bats there. So we know that there's new colonies. That opened the door, the stability and the growth and the new colonies and the actual protection of all of those caves made it so that we had a platform to announce that the species had recovered. So we announced that in the midst of a film, too, in 2013, that the species was recovered and now it's not an endangered species in Mexico anymore. And the U.S. delisted in 2017, so it's now a recovered species.
I mean, as you just said, you know, that was the first species to be removed from the endangered species list and the first species in Mexico to be officially saved. How did that feel to have that announcement made?
Oh, my God. Well, I have to tell you that that's a dream come true. That's a dream come true for every biologist in the world. You hope to see within your lifetime a species that you've devoted decades or years or whatever delisted. So this was an amazing opportunity. And, you know, I continue to celebrate and everything, but I do not stop worrying about them. And I am not going to stop working with them. Once we delisted them, then we started working to secure the ecosystem service they provide, which is pollination. And that is how we launched the Bat Friendly Tequila and Mezcal program 2 years later. And now that program is growing everywhere and everybody loves those bats. I wonder why.
From the last couple of decades of, well, more than two decades of work, is there one particular memory that stands out for you?
There's lots and lots of memories, but you know, the one that comes back time and again, time and again, time and again, and it repeats itself with every new cohort of students is their look of amazement and passion when they first get to see the lesser longnose bat. Many times it's the first bat that they've seen in their lives. And I put them in their hands and they go crazy. And that look in their eyes and that passion that I see is what feeds me. This is what I'm thriving on. I'm sort of a vampire of young energy, you know. That is how I work all the time.
A lot of our listeners here in the UK won't have seen what lesser longnose bats look like. Do you want to try and describe what they look like, which I know is difficult through audio, but do you want to give it a go?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The lesser longnose bat is one of the most personable bats that you will ever meet. It's got a small pair of ears. It's got a long snout. It's got a very long tongue. But the most amazing thing about them is their temper. They're absolutely kind. They will, a lesser longnose bat will never try to bite you compared to your pipistrel. You know, the lesser longnose bats simply do not bite. They don't. You just take them out of the net and they go, oh, what is this? Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Go ahead. Rub me. And you rub them and you take the wing punches and everything. And then you put the pit tags, you put the chips in them. And they are not biting. They're amazing. So they're like an ounce kind of bat, 28 grams, something like that. Very lightly brown, grayish color. No tail membrane and no tail to speak of. And, you know, big eyes, big inquisitive eyes, which always endear anybody and everyone who has seen a lesser longnose bat. It turns into their favorite bat.
Is it your favorite bat?
No, let me tell you. I mean, for example, National Geographic brings us explorers for what they call a closer look, which is basically you are asked to come to explain what you want to do next. And this is in 2015 that they called me for a closer look. And I said, okay, I know what I want to do. And I know that every bat biologist in the world wants to do the same thing. We all want to study the largest bat in the new world, Vampirum spectrum, the false vampire bat. This is an amazing species that is the largest bat in the continent that is a carnivore. But nobody knows anything about them. There's hardly any publications. Nobody knows where they live. They always are found in the most remote tropical rainforest areas, completely intact rainforest areas. And they're very, very scarce and they're endangered everywhere. And so one of the people who were in the audience said, all right, you've convinced me. This is good. I will give you the money as soon as you show me that you can find them. Because you say that they're very difficult to find, they're very rare, they're endangered, nobody knows anything about them. Well, there's a reason why, because nobody can find them. So if you go and find them, you got the money. So I went back to Mexico and I started a reward program in which I offered $1,000 per person who would bring me to a roost of Vampirum spectrum with the bats there, and then I'll give them $1,000. Within 5 months, I had 7 roosts. Wow. And a big hole in my pocket because this was my money, right? So then with that evidence and, you know, lots of videos and pictures and everything, I went back to DC and I showed them, okay, so here we are. I got 7 roosts, and then the money started flowing. And I've been studying these bats. Oh my God, they're fascinating. They're like a family. They live in families. They live in very small families. The male, the female, the young of the year, the young of the previous year, and that's it. They're really, really fascinating. So what I want to do is I am going to continue learning about these bats and hopefully protect them as well.
Nice. Have you got any plans for other species going forward?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we've been expanding and expanding. I have the biggest lab in my life right now. I have more students than I should. I have 30 students doing master's, PhD, etc. with me. Some of the other topics that we're working on are, for example, hibernation. Did you know that bats hibernate in Mexico? Well, they do. They do. And I'm going to say a few words about hibernating in Mexico tomorrow. But in the last 3 years, we started that project 3 years ago. We more than quadrupled the number of hibernacula known in Mexico. We now have 94 hibernacula, 70 more than we had only 3 years ago. So, and of course, this is in the wake of the white nose syndrome fungus moving into Mexico. It's going to come. So we've been swabbing bats and swabbing caves and so on, trying to document whether the fungus made it to Mexico or not. I am hopeful, knock on wood, I am hopeful that the Mexican winters are mild and short and dry compared to the winters in New England and the northeast of the United States where it's killed millions and millions of bats. So I don't think the fungus is going to find the conditions to kill many millions of bats in Mexico, but knock on wood.
And in terms of those hibernating bats, what species and are they in the same sort of numbers as you find in the United States? Obviously over here in the UK, we get very small numbers scattered. Is it more like the United States over there?
Good question. At the beginning of the project, we knew that there were 5 species of bats hibernating in Mexico. Now, with our project, we know that it's 12 species that are hibernating in Mexico. But yes, the hibernacula are small. The largest hibernaculum that we have is about 20,000 bats. And 20,000 is the biggest. All of the others are in the orders of 100, 200, 300, or maybe 10 or 20, especially if they are long-eared bats. They hibernate in 10 or 12 in a cave, and that's it.
And is it mainly caves or are there other structures as well?
So far, all of the hibernacula that we have are either in caves or in mines.
You kept vampire bats as a kid. Is that what it was that got you into bats in the first place, or was it something else? And what's your first ever memory of a bat?
Oh, no. I've had vampire bats in the family bathroom for a long time, but that was long coming. I mean, I started at a very early age. All my life has been around animals, and that's nothing against my family or anything. But, my first word was flamingo. So I've always been into animals all my life. And then when I was 11 years old, there was this TV contest on Mexico's national TV called the 64,000 peso contest, in which you choose a topic and they start asking questions and you double the amount of pesos that you win every time you answer correctly. I told my mom that I wanted to be asked questions about mammals. I could answer anything about mammals. And my mom said, no, you go and play with your friends. This is not for you. I insisted, and bless her heart, she took me to the producers. The producers said, no, a contest for people who have real information in their heads, and they're going to showcase it. So it's not for a kid to come and throw a ball at something and get some prize. No, this is not it. So my mom said, well, why don't you ask a kid a couple of questions and see? So they pulled out a book. They started asking questions and questions and questions and started responding and responding and responding. And pretty soon they said, well, congratulations, you're the first kid in the show. Everybody else were adults. I was the first one. All right, at 11. Then I started appearing, and I appeared like 6 or 7 weeks or something. And everybody's watching, because in Mexico there's only 3 channels at that time. Everyone is watching, including the dean of Mexican mammalogy, Bernardo Villa from the University of Mexico, who called me home. And he said, well, listen, I see that you're interested in mammals. Why don't you come over to the University of Mexico, and we will show you the real mammals that you're so interested. That was a dream come true for an 11-year-old like me. So I started going, and then when I was 12 years old, another scientist, another professor from the same lab took me to my first cave. And I have it branded with fire in my brain, because we went in. I was wearing a mask and gloves and all kinds of things, a very clunky, humongous headlamp, etc. And then he grabbed a California nose leaf bat, which is a beautiful animal. And he put one, that was the first one in my hand. He put it in my hand and he said, what do you see? Tell me what you see and tell me what you think it does. So, of course, I went, my God, what is this? The big ears, the nose leaf, the wings, everything was just blowing my mind away. So I started describing, I said, well, I don't know. I think it may be listening for insects that call in the bush, and they take, yes, look at the under the roost. There's a lot of wings of, you know, grasshoppers and things like that. So he takes that out and he puts another one. And what does he do? And so on and so forth. So in that one cave, I got to know the vampire bats, a couple of insectivorous bats, and the lesser longnose bat as well.
Nice. 2 more questions, then we'll go get some dinner because we're both starving. Yeah. Here. What did it feel like on the Batman of Mexico? There's something called the volcano of, and I'm going to pronounce this wrong, the volcano of
Calakmul. Say it again.
Calakmul.
Thank you. What did it feel like watching that emergence for the first time? and describe it for listeners as well.
The Bat Volcano of Calakmul is one of the most magical places on Earth. Many biologists and many filmmakers have been there with me, and they all say, this is the most fascinating place I've been. The experience is out of this world. So imagine a sinkhole that is dry, that is about maybe 40 or 50 meters deep and about 60 to 80 meters wide. And then all the way to the bottom, there is the entrance of the cave. And the bats start swirling at 6 p.m., 7 p.m. They start swirling and swirling and swirling, and they start rising and rising and rising. They go in front of your eyes, and they continue to rise because they have to rise above the level of the canopy of the forest that is surrounding you. This is all tropical rainforest as far as you can see. So the bats continue to rise and rise and rise and rise, and then they form a column and they head south. And I still need to find out where are they going to feed. We don't know. And you see the column going up like that. And as far as you can see, it's all tropical rainforest. And then you find up to 20 predatory birds that are coming and swooping and taking bats in front of your eyes right there. It's a total of about 3 million bats that come out from that cave. It's mind-blowing. It's 6 species. One of them represents about 80% of those bats there. So it's absolutely fascinating.
Sounds amazing. What do you think the challenges are going to be in the future for bat conservation?
Well, we have the challenge in front of us. We've had the challenge for a long time in front of us, and that is a lack of information, of real information. As you know, there's a lot of people who still blame bats for COVID, and that is absolutely not true. COVID is a human disease that if you're going to get it, you're going to get it from another human being. It's not true that bats are going to give you COVID. So, unfortunately, there are some scientists who have been scaring people into thinking that bats are going to give us the next pandemic, that bats are going to... I mean, please, we've been coexisting with bats since our very early childhood as human beings, because we started living as human beings in caves together with bats. Are we dead? No. We are here, and we're going to continue being here. So the main threat around the world is still lack of information in the general people. Now, above and beyond that, yes, we all have a pending task to do, especially in the United Kingdom. We know that wind energy is a major bat killer, and we have to enact mitigation measures. The mitigation measures need to become law in your country and in my country. And we're fighting to make that a reality.
Rodrigo Medin, it's been an honor to have you on the podcast. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Steve, for having me.
Rodrigo is one of those people you could spend all day talking to and it still wouldn't be enough time. His enthusiasm is infectious and his talk the next day was the best I've ever seen open a conference. You can find links to Rodrigo's work in the show notes along with his social media pages. We've also included a link to bat-friendly tequila brands. Join me next time when I'll be in the east of England learning how a controversial road scheme could impact a super colony of some of our rarest bats. What did you think of this episode? If you can please leave a quick comment about the show in the ratings and review section, we'd really appreciate it. It helps other listeners to discover our podcast.